The scripture reading today is from Paul's second letter to the Corinthians, chapter 4, verses 7 through 18, which can be found in your pew Bible starting on page 939. Hear the word of the Lord. But we have this treasure in clay jars, so that it may be made clear that this extraordinary power belongs to God and does not come from us. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not driven to despair, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed, always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be made visible in our bodies. For while we live, we are always being given up to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus may be made visible in our mortal flesh. So death is at work in us, but life in you. But just as we have the same spirit of faith that is in accordance with Scripture, I believed, and so I spoke. We also believe, and so we speak. Because we know that the one who raised the Lord Jesus will raise us also with Jesus, and will bring us with you into his presence. Yes, everything is for your sake, so that grace, as it extends to more and more people, may increase thanksgiving to the glory of God. So we do not lose heart. Even though our outer nature is wasting away, our inner nature is being renewed day by day. For this slight momentary affliction is preparing us for an eternal weight of glory beyond all measure. Because we look not at what can be seen, but at what cannot be seen. For what can be seen is temporary, but what cannot be seen is eternal. The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
It's good to be here today. I'm thankful that David Rennick does not have a real good memory, because it was about 30 years ago I preached at his church. It was his first Sunday there, and we were halfway between the United States and selling all of our property and getting kids 2, 4, 6, and 8 years old all packed up to go to Singapore to leave North America. And I don't think it was a very good sermon, frankly. I was preoccupied with everything. Did I make the right decision? And I preached. I don't have a clue what I said. And so I think David forgot, and thank you for the invitation to come back. I'd like to begin today by thanking the leadership of the church for this invitation and opportunity. This is a very important church in history. Some great people have come through here, and I can see that a lot of great people are still here. But I also thank you for taking the risk of having a historian preach. You're going to get a lot of history this morning. I'm also a pastor, but I do history usually Monday through Fridays. This is an important time for me to be here also, because next week it will be 70 years ago that Fuller Theological Seminary started. And I'm a dean at Fuller, so we're celebrating our 70th anniversary. You are celebrating your 70th anniversary of the formation, the official formation of this church. Did you know that? It's on your website. So I know it's true. I read it on the web, Dad. I know it's true. So congratulations on 70 years, 50 years for the building, so we can all celebrate together. We have a lot to be thankful for. God's faithfulness through the decades, through these institutions dedicated to his service. If ever there were a passage of Scripture that flies in the face of our culture, this is it. Were you listening carefully to what Donna said? Everything in our culture tells us to serve yourself, save yourself, pamper yourself, care for yourself, love yourself. Our passage today talks about the exact opposite. It describes the Christian as one who is afflicted, crushed, perplexed, struck down, who's carrying around in us death. How depressing is that? Hey, pastor, sign me up for that one. That sounds great. Better yet, why don't you just choose another passage, something more upbeat? Actually, it's right. It's not very attractive, but it is one of the most important passages for us who live in an affluent and self-absorbed culture to hear. I would like to suggest that we are not looking at a side issue, a little element of the Christian life. We are drilling down at the very core of the Christian life, of Christian existence, the foundation upon which salvation is built. The gospel is costly, not cheap. The gospel is grace and joy for us on the other side of suffering and even death. Death brings life. Living for others is life for us. Power is found in weakness. Suffering is the path to glory. Let me tell you a story to illustrate this. I was invited once by a very secular Maoist university in China, which will not go named. Wonderful people were there who in the past had only studied everything from an economic determinist point of view. And all of a sudden, the history department had a lot of people studying the history of Christianity. And so the chairman of the department invited me to come and speak because he knew I wrote about Asian Christianity. And my assignment was, can you help the students? There are about 35, 40 with about 8 faculty in this master's program understand how to study Christianity, because it just doesn't make sense. They can study, you know, political history and international relations and economics, but when it came to Christianity, they couldn't understand why would these people come halfway around the world, and then they would lose a wife and a child, and they'd come back, and then they'd be persecuted, and they'd come back, and they'd set up hospitals and feed people during a famine. It didn't make sense. So my assignment was to make sense of how is it you study Christianity. I'd never thought about that before. And so I thought about our son, who's an accountant. I said, let's say you're studying the history of an accounting firm or a bank, an investment company. You would ask certain questions. Who are the original investors? Were they trying to make a lot of money to help other people? What are the principles, the guidelines that they worked under? Who are the people on the board? Where do they set up new branches? Why? So those are the kind of questions you would ask to understand an investment firm or an accounting firm. But for Christianity, what questions do we ask to understand its history? And so I said to them, I said, basically, what you have to remember about Christianity is it's a centered set religion. It's not bounded where you have to follow these different rules and fit in, but it's all focused on the center. And the understanding of people's behaviors and what they do in the institutions is all based on the center. And I said, for example, in China, many of you have seen churches. And on the outside of a church, or inside, I haven't checked here. Is there a cross around here somewhere? Ah, yes, thank you, there it is. Note to self, be sure to look around before you do the sermon. So I said, what do you see on a church? And there was a young woman sitting down. A cross, sir. And I said, well, what does a cross mean? I do not know, sir. So I said, does anybody know what does a cross symbolize? Why do they have a cross there? Nobody. Students, faculty, nobody raised their hand. So I'm in a dilemma. I thought they would know. I said, well, a cross represents Jesus Christ because Christians believe that God created the world, you see, and then there's a problem. And so I basically had to tell the whole story of creation and redemption. How do you explain what the cross means without talking about Jesus who became human, humiliated, humbled himself, came upon earth to show us how to live, to talk, to show the works of God, the compassion of God in the flesh. And then that was not appreciated. And so he was killed. And we remember his life given for us with a cross. So I got done, and the professor animately got up and started speaking very fast in Chinese. I didn't have a clue what he was saying. I thought I was in trouble. I just gave this beautiful Christian testimony to this Maoist university about Jesus Christ. And then he turned to me and he said, thank you so much. I've been trying to tell them that they need to know about Jesus if they're going to understand about Christianity. And then he gave me an uncharacteristically Chinese hug in the middle of the class. He was overwhelmed. Now, I suspect, you know, he was a believer or very sympathetic to the Christian faith, and he was finally glad that somebody could tell him, yeah, you can't understand Christian history unless you understand Jesus. And so I was blown away by that. I said, it's true. What Christians do is dependent upon our participation in the life of Jesus Christ, following him. It's a story of a suffering God who brings victory over death and future glory to come. The center, the core of the Christian faith is the cross. And this is what explains the willingness of Christians to suffer for God's mission. The religions of humanity cannot make this up. This is not reasonable, nor is it an easy truth. This morning we will look at how this core of the gospel propels us into mission in the world. Or more to the point, how our calling to proclaim the good news blossoms out of the fertile soil of God's story grounded in suffering. My goal is that we will become stronger in resisting our cultural bondage and find new life in being faithful even through suffering and humiliation, so that others might hear and see Jesus. So you can remember these three easy points, and if you fall asleep, they'll come back to you and you'll make some sense of it later on. Weak, powerful, speak. Weak, powerful, speak. Weak. This is about as countercultural as we can get. The gospel requires a weakness, a surrender, a willingness to suffer, to co-suffer with Jesus, which is compassion, to co-suffer. We receive Jesus with open hearts, with open hands. We have nothing to offer. The cry of the conquering Christian is not, I did it my way, but I give up. I surrender. We have a tradition of praying on our knees. This is surrender. We also have a tradition of raising our hands in praise and thanksgiving. That's also, well, maybe not in National Presbyterian Church, but in many churches, we raise our hands in praise. And that's a sign not of conquest, but of that's surrender. Paul says, and it's affirmed throughout the New Testament, that those who will follow Jesus Christ will suffer. He doesn't say might, or some of you might. No, those who follow Jesus Christ will suffer. Jesus' life shows this element of suffering. Paul's life shows it. Christian history shows it again and again. In contrast, our culture teaches us very clearly, you can do your work well if you just work harder, and you can get enough people to look at it on Facebook or on Twitter. Advertising, social media, the entertainment world and books, movies, television, program, teach us very clearly to obsess over yourself and your ability to work it out on your own. The strong, strategic, and the sly, they win. You are destined to win. Be strong. Don't show your weakness. We're all being formed, discipled in this way 24/7. We're bombarded with messages of self-reliance. As Americans, this is our approach. We can do this. But in fact, we are weak and frail and hard-pressed, and we don't get it right, and that's okay. It is best to admit this, even if we do not feel so weak and frail at the time. I love worship, and one of the reasons I love worship is I can come in and I can just say, I can't do it. We confess sin every week. It's a beautiful, wonderful thing. We're demanded to kind of get it together and be right and to give the right answer and get the reports done on time and to anticipate what other people are going to do. And then we come here, we can just say, Lord, I failed, I'm tired, I'm weak. That kind of honesty and humility is refreshing. Thank God for worship. History lesson number one. Since I'm a historian, I'll offer three little vignettes of history to illustrate. The first one here comes from China. The 20th century reveals the weakness, oppression, and the victory of the gospel in China. The Chinese church opened up in 1900 with a Boxer Rebellion. Missionaries and all foreigners were rejected. It was awful. I've read a lot of the stories and narratives the last couple weeks. I've been reading it. It was not pretty at all. It looked like it was going to be the end of about 93 years of Protestant mission in China. Slowly, things changed. Missionaries came back. They built more hospitals and schools. And then, boom, the 1920s, anti-foreignism in China, another wave of it. And then the Japanese come in, and you have Japanese occupation, and many of these universities and seminaries and hospitals move to the West to get away from the Japanese occupation. Things begin to kind of come back, and then all of a sudden, Mao and the liberation under Mao comes. And churches go underground, seminaries are closed, hospitals are taken over, schools are taken over by the government. Many Christians are put in persecution camps. I have met people who were in prison 15, 20 years. It looked like a complete failure. In 1948, there was estimated about 1.5 million Christians in all of the largest nation in the world, only 1.5 million. We thought in the West that it was a failure and that now the church was snuffed out. It's over. Who ever would have guessed that after a period of time when 50 to 60 million people died of starvation under the Great Leap Forward, the church was slowly germinating and sending out roots and shoots, and that today about 130 million Bibles have been printed in China with government approval, even support. And there could be probably about 100 million Christians in China after all of that, that persecuted church. Christianity went underground, survived, returned, and is one of the modern Christian miracles. We never guessed it. We never predicted it. They were persecuted, forced down on every side. Powerful, powerful. Again, this is quite countercultural, so listen carefully. Paul is saying basically that if we work really hard to prove that we're powerful enough and really serving a great God, if we really work hard at that, then we've lost the divine power to make a difference in this world. That's right. Trust self, lose God's power. But if we accept our nature as broken, weak, and powerless vessels, like the vessels here, they can do nothing unless animated by an elder or a pastor. They just sit there. Come on, vessel, do something. That's what we are, unless they're filled with the Spirit of the living God. But if we accept our nature as broken, weak, and powerless, then there is extraordinary power that will become manifest in our lives to the world. Our self-confidence clouds God's divine power. Our self-confidence to fix ministry fences out God. Our anxiety to do well for God denies faith in God. However, we, you see, are not on the throne. Jesus is on the throne. I really believe this, friends. I have worked with many Christian organizations, seminaries, mission societies, churches, presbyteries, many different committees, and it's very hard to live this truth. I'm sure some of you feel the same way at times. Things aren't going right. We just need to work harder. We need to have more meetings. We need to meet longer. We need to bring in more consultants when things aren't going right. We have to work harder, meet longer, meet more often, do more and more and more. It's such an inviting and reasonable trap to fall into. But Paul says no. In weakness and submission comes extraordinary power. Of all times, now we need power. We need real power in ministry to bring about the peace, the reconciliation, certainly in our culture, the liberation, the salvation, and healing that is needed in the world today. The power is available, and God really, really, really wants to bring about this change. He really wants to pour out this power, but we keep playing the wrong part. We're the young woman who was cast for Juliet in Shakespeare's tragedy, but we keep wanting to direct the play. It all gets messed up. She never learns her lines. She's supposed to submit and take the direction, but instead she tries to direct. It all gets messed up because she's not attentive and submissive. It needs to be said that this power from God is really powerful. This is more than we can imagine, and it's better than we hoped for. History lesson two. Africa had centuries of imperial missionaries from Portugal, from Spain, from England, from Netherlands, from Belgium, etc., coming to work on the coattails of these great imperial powers. The missionaries came to preach, to learn languages, to set up schools, to set up hospitals and clinics. And yet the power of empires actually prevented the gospel for the poor from spreading. I was taught in good history departments at major universities and seminaries that basically the reason Christianity spread is because the colonial empires were there and missionaries came in the coattails of the empires. Empirically, that's not true. Sure, they came on the same ships, but that's not why Christianity grew. Statistics speak very loudly. In 1900, there were only 9 million Christians after 350 years of missionary work in Africa. 9 million Christians in the whole continent of Africa. And as late as 1962, almost two-thirds of the way through the 20th century, there were still only 60 million. From 9 million to 60 million. Well, that's a lot of growth, right? Not really. By 62, most of the colonial powers had left. Nationalism had taken place in Africa. 60 million Christians in the whole continent, and it looked like Christianity would decline because the imperial powers that supported missions were gone. With all of the powerful missionary work in 62 years, they only had grown by 51 million. But after those empires left, the church in Africa grew from 60 million to 100 million, 150 million, 360 million. From 60 million to 360 million in a third of a century. Friends, in the first two-thirds, with all the support from colonial powers, Christianity only grew to 60 million. In only 40 years, less than 40 years, it grew to 360. That had never happened in the history of Christianity in the world. Nothing in the history of Christianity could have predicted this. Never. This Christian growth was in the poorest continent with some of the greatest social and political upheavals of our time. Independence movements. The power of God is not to be compared with empires and armies. In our own lives, God's power is waiting for our humility. Would you have great power in ministry and evangelism? Then seek humility. Finally, speak. Finally, our acceptance of our weakness and our joy in God's greatness is to be for the sake of others. Yes? Paul is ultimately concerned that we get our theology right and that we act in the right way in imitation of Christ in all that we do, so that others might believe. Listen to some of the words from our passage that show Paul's ultimate concern. He just doesn't want to talk about something depressing about being persecuted and crushed. What he really wants is he cares about others so that the life of Jesus may be made visible in our bodies, so that death is at work in us, but life in you. I believe, and so I spoke. We also believe, and so we speak. Yes, everything is for your sake, so that grace, as it extends to more and more people. That is what Paul cares about. It's a simple truth. Our life has value to the extent it is emptied out for others. That's the value of a life. It's absolutely true. Our actual life's value is measured in the lives of others who have been transformed by our service and our speaking. Paul talks about, I believe, therefore I speak. The reason for our suffering and being crushed is so that God's power would be poured out for others. That's a life worth living. History. Christian history is filled with examples here. I'd like to speak for hours about this, but I know we have other things to do and I want to eat lunch. I'm writing this fall about Asian Christianity in the 20th century. The suffering is so great, and yet in the midst of the great suffering, Christianity grew by more than four times, over 400% the percentage that it had in 1900. From 2% of the Asian population in 1900 to over 9%, close to 10% of the Asian population today. How can that be? Here's an example. And there are millions of these examples. So just thank God for all the little people like this. Mrs. Diep Thi Do is an example, a Vietnamese widow. Mrs. Diep and her husband had served as missionaries, Vietnamese missionaries working among the Montagnard people, the mountain people, called the Steng, S-T-I-E-N-G. In 1975, you know what was going on in Vietnam in 1975? Her husband was captured by the communists. She never heard from him again. For 6 years, she struggled to stay quiet and survive, to not be noticed. It was a time of terrible persecution for the church. In 1981, at the market, she met some very discouraged Steng people in the marketplace. They recognized her. A few of them pleaded with her to come back and be their pastor. We need you. Would you come back and be our pastor? She relented. It was very difficult because the authorities outlawed missionary work among tribals. She had been hiding, and now she was going to go public. Many times soldiers tried to block her way, but she said, and I quote, "With God's help, I stared them down." Now, I've been to Saigon, and I've talked to some pastors who said the same thing. The communists try to go to people's homes on Sunday morning with rifles and tell them not to go to church. It's legal to go to church, so they can't prevent them, but they say, we just stare them down. And then we go into the police station and we yell at them for what they're doing. I don't think I would have that kind of courage. She bravely went throughout the Steng region, fearlessly doing battle with government authorities to reopen closed churches in the 1980s and 90s, long before the current thaw in government attitudes toward religion. She presided over the construction of the largest building, church building in Vietnam, the Phuc Long Church, seating 2,000 people. How many does this seat here? Okay, bigger. Let me quote from a book that was written about this period of time. Although the Protestant Church in Vietnam does not ordain women, she performed all pastoral functions, marrying, burying, appointing leaders, administering the sacraments, preaching, teaching. Her bravery and her spiritual authority ensured that no one ever challenged her operating essentially as a bishop. She described herself as, "I'm only a little woman. I'm only a little woman, a little vessel." But her faith, her trust in God, her submission to God, made her a giant in the lives of the Steng Christians she had served for 55 years. More than 4,000 came to her funeral when she died at 84 years old, faithful until the end. Nothing will silence an individual who is dying so others can live. As I mentioned above, for 5 months I'm working on research and writing the history of Christianity in Asia in the 20th century. I have found that it is a history that is hard to read. Every time I turn a page, there's more persecution and death. It is unbelievable. The Boxer Rebellion, the Armenian Genocide, Lebanese Civil Wars, plural, India Partition, Japanese Empire, Mao's Great Leap Forward, Pol Pot, Vietnam, North Korea. The stories are horrific, and they just keep coming. But as I work in the library, I've carved out my little table, and I get there right at 8:30 when it opens so nobody will take it. Because I'm thankful to be seated with the fellowship of the suffering. Over my left shoulder is this beautiful painting of Horace Tracy Pitkin, 1869-1900, 31 years old. I know his story. After sending his wife and son in 1899, after only 3 years sending them back from China, he stayed behind in Shandong province to help keep the mission station open, to encourage the Chinese in the Boxer Rebellion, and to defend two single missionary women. They were trapped in a building when the Boxers came. They fled from one building to another, finally to a shed. The Boxers came, and they cut off his head. I'm sitting in the library and reminded of that witness and that testimony, and I think now of Christianity in China, afflicted in every way but not crushed, struck down but not destroyed. It all seemed so hopeless and lost in Vietnam, in Cambodia, in 1975, in 1980, even in 1990. Today, the blood of these martyrs has become the seed of a vibrant church. The Chinese church is now becoming a strong missionary church, sending missionaries throughout Asia, the Middle East, and Africa. I have, in fact, met Chinese missionaries in Cambodia and in Egypt. So we're starting to teach in Chinese at Fuller Theological Seminary. But we have this treasure in clay jars, so that it may be made clear that this extraordinary power belongs to God, does not come from us. We're afflicted in every way, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not driven to despair. Persecuted, not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may be made visible in our bodies. For while we live, we're always being given up to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus may be made visible in our mortal flesh. So death is at work in us, but life in you. Thanks be to God.